Fashion Tech Applied is published. My co-authored book taking you through 6 chapters and covering the technologies and innovations powering the fashion industry. I'm Peter Jun Ho Sang, founder and CEO of Beyond Form, and welcome to the special podcast series Applied. Each episode, I'll be sitting down with incredible fashion tech professionals that are featured inside the book. On today's episode, I'm sitting down with Jonathan Chippendale, CEO of Helition, a creative studio dreaming of some of the most beautiful digital campaigns for the world's most famous luxury brands. I've known Jonathan for over a decade, which means in that timeline, I've also seen how his studio has evolved creatively as the technology advanced. If you've ever stepped into his office, you'll understand why some people might call him the Willy Wonka of digital marketing campaigns. In featured in chapter 4 of the book, we delve really deep into what makes Jonathan tick and how he manages to create visual delights to the point where people weep.
It was the music that made it moving. It was the non-tech bit that made it moving. Don't try and reduce our clients to tears. It does happen from time to time, but it was lovely. It was really nice, and it was in exactly the right kind of way. We'd triggered something within her. So the first aim was like to slow everything down. And if everything about fashion shows are about hype and movement, slow that down. The fashion goes down, they turn, fashion comes back again, and that's it. You just don't see it.
So let's get started with the conversation with Jonathan on this episode of Venturing into Fashion Tech. How are you today, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, not feeling amazing. Seem to have got the dreaded COVID, but I'm pushing my way through it. We're going to be fine. Positive mental attitude is going to carry me through this interview, this podcast.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time out. I'm going to start the episode by giving some context and setting the scene for our listeners. So we're talking about Helition, and we're talking about digital marketing and digital activations. You're featured in chapter 4 of the book. I've known you for quite a long time now, Jonathan. I think over 10 years. So I followed Helition's journey.
Yeah,
exactly. You followed my journey, and we're still here basically battling it out in the entrepreneurship business world basically. But we haven't actually done anything publicly together before.
No, I'm glad that we're putting that right.
Exactly. And now we get to share what normally is within the confines of the Helition office and brainstorming and chit-chat, but now we're making that public, essentially. But let me set the scene. So 71% of fashion executives plan to spend more on brand marketing in 2024 than in previous years, and that's according to the BOF State of Fashion report that was released at the end of 2023. It goes on to say that consumers expect to see brand stories that are consistent and authentic, and I think that Helition is one of the very few agencies that do this exceptionally well, creating authentic stories. You work with specifically, or most of your clients are quite high-end luxury brands, and luxury brands are spending 33% of their advertising budgets on digital marketing, according to Gartner. So that's quite a high number. The world's top luxury groups, LVMH, Coty, and Kering Group, spent 6.69 billion US dollars on ads in 2020, according to Statista. Creating visually beautiful ads that emotionally engage with the consumer is key to seeing a positive ROI on all of that ad spend. This is where Helition comes in, and you are one of the masters of that, you yourself and your team, shall we say. I was reading, actually, your bio on the University of the Arts London website, because you have an honorary doctorate. When did you get that? Because I didn't realize you had one of those, actually, until I Googled you.
I know. I mean, it must be when I got a letter from the Vice-Chancellor saying that they very kindly awarded me an honorary doctorate for, I'm blushing even to say it, but I mean, for an outstanding contribution to the world of digital retail and fashion. You know, I assumed it was a practical joke from one of my team. And it wouldn't have surprised me. I had to check the diary and make sure it wasn't April the 1st. But we've done lots of work with London College of Fashion over the years. And in fact, just working with universities has been very, very important for us. It's been a very important part of our journey. And it's been two-way traffic. I mean, on the one hand, a lot of my team come straight from university. And that might mean they come from UCL, you know, in their late 20s with a PhD in computing science, or they may come age 22 with an MA in fashion psychology from London College of Fashion, or narrative environments from Central St. Martin's, but there, a lot of them start from university, and that's because we talk a lot at university and talk with university students. And I think the other thing that I find fantastic about talking to students and working with students and is that quite early on, and this is going to sound really rather arrogant and silly, but quite early on, having come from luxury myself, and that was where I started, I was very keen that it was critical that I would not employ anybody that has spent considerable time in luxury, fashion, or beauty. And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, having come from luxury, there's in many brands, and I don't think it's quite the same now. I think digital has kind of unlocked a lot more sort of positivity and openness and interest in exploring new areas. But when I was in luxury, no one ever got fired for saying no. People only got fired for saying yes. And there was a definite feeling of inertia and not wanting to put your head above the parapet and not wanting to take too much risk. And, you know, what we do at Halition is all about risk and trying to have an understanding about where our brand's appreciation for risk lies and to butt ideas right up on that spot and even to go beyond that and encourage brands to kind of go into slightly unknown areas. And I didn't really want anybody in the team that had had a whole career of being kind of indoctrinated into saying no. So what's great about, you know, the people that work at Halition is not having come from that corporate world, they don't have those inhibitions and they can, you know, I love that magic moment of serendipity when we get a brief from Chanel. I can throw it into a room with a mathematician, a psychologist, and a filmmaker. And what comes out is often wrong. Because they don't understand necessarily the kind of limitations or the environment of that luxury brand. But it's unusual and it's different. And then with my luxury experience, I can then fine-tune it and bring it into a kind of area which I think sits on where that kind of particular brand's acceptance of innovation lies. So what's great about working with universities and working with students is that you just get this openness and this kind of willingness to kind of explore. And also what you get is real relevancy because, you know, I'm in my 50s now and, you know, my generation's looking at retirement. I mean, I've got huge amounts of experience. I think I've got the experience, but I think my team's got the relevance. And like relevance is really important. Obviously, it's really important. It's particularly important now with the predomination of social media and the speed of change and the speed of innovation. You know, having people living and breathing that innovation as individuals, as members of my team, kind of outside of Halition, means that actually, when it comes to thinking about some of those projects that you were referring to, Peter, that we do, it means that we understand the tools and how those tools are changing and what is absolutely on the zeitgeist of today. And again, you know, working with younger people that kind of are digitally native and sort of understand these tools is a real powerful driver of innovation and change and kind of freedom of thought.
When did you actually get the...
But that's not the question you asked me.
But that's fine. When did you actually get the honorary doctorate? I didn't realize actually you received one.
I know. Heavens, it must have... It was before the pandemic. So about 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. And I had to make the speech at the Royal Festival Hall. And actually what was really nice is in January, I was asked to be part of a UK trade delegation by the UK government to New York. And it ended up the very last night, they had a sort of cocktail sort of party at the residence of the consulate, which is at the very top of a tower looking out over the UN in New York and over the Hudson River. And there was a startup that is doing very, very well, has raised quite a lot of money, and they do virtual spaces for retail stores. And I was having a chat to the founder of it, and she said she was one of the students that heard me speak. When I received my doctorate, she was receiving her degree, and she was there with her parents in the festival hall, hearing Jonathan's apparent words of wisdom.
On the university's website, they do describe you as the Willy Wonka, and I think you mentioned it there, as about taking people out of their comfort zones. It's about taking risk, as we all know, the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, that is essentially what he is doing. So you, Jonathan, as the Willy Wonka of digital technologies and fashion and digital marketing, you know, you have helped shape some of the world's oldest and largest luxury brands and how they use technology to tell, as you were saying there, relevant stories to the consumer. But I want to know about you. how did you reach that stage? How did you become the Willy Wonka of technology and specifically digital marketing?
Well, first of all, on the Willy Wonka thing, I mean, I'm not even sure how old Coalition is anymore. I can't remember when I started it up, but I mean, it's sort of 16 or 17 years ago now. And when we started, we were one of the very, very, very first sort of UK fashion tech, retail tech startups. There were one or two others, but I can't remember who they were, and they're not around anymore. And so we were really very much a sort of early start. And being early means that everything that you do happens to be a world first and happens to be, and if it's digital, you know, in a world where no one really sort of got digital. And just to be clear, you know, most of the clients that we work with, you know, in those days, many of them didn't even have a website. And if they did have a website, it was more about the location of the stores and the opening hours and the telephone numbers and how to get there. It wasn't about, you know, all the stuff that we talk about now. So a lot of these brands were very sort of backward thinking, not so much now, but definitely then. So everything that we were doing was kind of unusual and mad and crazy, and using technology to wear things, using augmented reality, doing fashion shows, using holography, creating three auto-stereoscopic 3D visual merchandising windows for brands. You know, everything felt really different and unusual. And that's where that rather embarrassing comment came from. And particularly, we'd just done a piece of work with Hermes where we had created a series of clothes that changed color according to the air quality that you walked through. And every item of clothing reported back to the brand every 3 hours with the location of the product and the color. And therefore, we were able to map a city. And that idea was so sort of unusual that I think that's where that Willy Wonka thing came from, because we were, and it goes back to what you were talking about right at the beginning of this, Peter, because I'm a classically trained analog luxury marketing director. And that was my first 25 years or 20 years, whatever it was, before Coalition. And marketing, it's all about sort of understanding human behavior and using those insights to tell stories. Because what is a brand if it's not a collection of stories? And in the analog world, the stories were about product and logo and color and store and history and heritage. And of course, in today's world, you can add to that, you know, conversations around culture and politics and environment and sustainability and art and, you know, personality and just the level of stories are all sort of completely different and kind of varied. So when we started Coalition, rather than think about technology, and it's still very much the way that we work now, we're kind of technology last. We're sort of, I mean, we're sometimes called anti-technology technologists, because it's never about the technology. What we try and do is understand the consumer, because that's like the first rule of marketing. Who is your consumer? Who are you talking to? What are their motivations? Who is the brand? What is the brand? What is that brand's personality? How does that brand differentiate from its competition? Where are the interesting areas of exploration and discovery for that brand? So thinking strategically, but then very quickly thinking creatively about how to deliver that opportunity. And what we found over the years is that if you think strategically and then creatively, the right technology self-selects itself. So we're technology last. And I think that notion of thinking creatively, but using technology to amplify creative thought and creative thinking basically means that at the heart of it, Coalition, we create narratives. We are storytellers. And it's not the technology. It's a story that you tell using that technology. And we often talk about the notion of, like, you can have the world's most expensive high-quality television, but if you're watching bad content, your experience is poor. You know, likewise, on your mobile phone, you could watch a great old classic black and white film, you know, Casablanca or something, and it's a really great story, really beautifully told and well acted, and you can still have a great experience. So really early on, we sort of were not about the technology. The technology was a tool. In some ways, denigrate the technology, hide it away, so that the story is not about VR or AI or AR or whatever it is. That kind of terminology just made our hearts sink, you know, to the bottom of the earth. We just felt that's not who we are as humans. Like, I'm not interested in AR, but I'm very interested in how AR can tell stories. And then what are those stories? And then particularly for us, we're just very, very interested in stories that in some ways kind of help you understand more about yourself or what it's like to be human or what is your role in the world or in the kind of ecosystem within which you kind of operate. Things that kind of help, that give you insights, I think are very much kind of an area of interest. And you know, those insights even though they have a fashion element or a luxury element or a beauty element, those insights can be around climate change or refugees or dementia or mental health, or, you know, these are all projects that we've done. I mean, even, you know, things around Afghanistan and Iraq or genocide in Rwanda, you know, we kind of work in these areas which are really important to us as human beings. And I think that is one aspect that differentiates lots of our work. I mean, yes, we do, you know, things that sell handbags and things that sell more lipsticks, but there's another class of work that we do, again, in the fashion space, but sort of talks about bigger things. And it just plays to that idea we were referring to about 5 or 10 minutes ago, which is that storytelling and kind of brands. We sort of look at brands now as having much more elastic identities. They're not rigid. You know, they can talk about one thing one day, a different thing another day. They can have a view on Black Lives Matter. They can have a view on climate change. You know, they're sort of like humans, right? We all have different levels of understanding and different interests and different loves. And, you know, we are wonderfully individual, all of us. You know, we're all fundamentally different people. I think the bit that I find really interesting are those brands that, are becoming much more nebulous and much more amorphous and have got different stories for different types of customers. And therefore, the brand is different. I'm always reminded of the teachers that I kind of value when I was a kid, are the ones that encouraged me to find out for myself rather than tell me what to think. And I think, you know, as an analog marketing director in the old days, in the pre-digital days, we used to tell people what to think. We created brand worlds. We told women what to wear and how to wear it before they even knew it themselves, or so we liked to kid ourselves that we believed. But actually nowadays, that just sounds crass, right? And actually brands are about everything that it's about everything else beyond the product that makes those brands interesting. We want to be surprised. And by the way, fashion is all about surprising, right? Like fashion is always about newness and what's different. And you know, I wasn't expecting that. And wow, they've got a really interesting point there. So again, that sort of slightly, that degree of nebulosity around a brand in its communication, it's absolutely what they should be looking at.
Just for the context of our listeners, how do you describe then Helician? Because you are telling stories, you're using technology, you are digital, you are marketing. So how do you encapsulate all of that into Helician?
One of the things I thought was fascinating for me, and one of my sort of learnings as I started all of this, was, again, coming from a brand, particularly as a strategic marketing director, you know, it was all about control. And it was all about thinking quite heavily and seriously about the right move. Before you take a step forward, you reconnoiter the ground, you check your direction, you research, you talk, and by the time you finally put that foot down, you're comfortable that you're heading in the right direction. When I started Helician, I very quickly realized that actually my ability to control the world around me was less than zero, quite frankly. There was, you know, we had ideas, but clients had different ideas. The economics and the environment that within which we operated in were different ideas. Consumers had different ideas. And therefore, we didn't really have any sort of ability there. So we've tried to weaponize that, I guess, into some kind of superpower. So the answer to your question, Peter, is we deliberately don't define ourselves in any way. And we talk about the fact that technology is still changing and adapting and modifying. And by the way, the stories that are relevant, they're still changing. You know, they're constantly evolving. I mean, you know, a few years ago, we were doing lots of stories about diversity. And before that, we were doing stories about climate change. And before that, we were doing stories about diversity. And you know, we want to be free and untethered from kind of like what everybody else is talking about. We want to be able to be nimble and agile and talk about tomorrow's stories. Some people call us creative technologists, and I can get that. Because Helician definitely operates at that junction, that intersection where kind of science meets art, that kind of cultural middle bit there. And what I mean by that is like harnessing science, harnessing art, but using that to tell a cultural story. That's definitely something in that area of luxury fashion and beauty. But I think we're also in some ways a practice-based consultancy, because a lot of what we try and do is think about not like VR and AR and tech, as I mentioned, but actually what are the future? What are the future directions? I mean, there's been a lot of conversation around Apple's new headset, the Pro. Whether you like it or not, it's the very, very, very worst Apple headset that will ever be made, because the next one will be better, and the next one will be better, and the next one will be better. If you can think into the future and think about the role of technology and the power of technology into the future, then actually a very important thing happens. You can think about the importance of that technology without being hindered by the kind of by the inadequacies of the hardware. Because hardware gets better and technologies get better. It's one of the biggest issues that I think our clients struggle with. You know, our clients want a piece of technology and they want it perfect from day one. But that's not technology. That's not how technology works. If you look at the first car, the first airplane, the first computer, the first television, the first mobile, you know, it gets better and better and better over the years. But I think a lot of retailers think of it like a handbag or a shoe. I need to make it as perfect as possible, and then I can sell it because I'm all about kind of quality. So thinking about kind of technology in 5 years' time or 10 years' time is kind of, again, what we do. And then the projects that we do, they're like little steps of exploration and discovery on those particular routes. And we look at the world over four kind of core, what we at Azure call giga trends, rightly or wrongly. And we sort of map and track and deliver technology down these kind of four trends. One of them is around meta-human and that idea of avatars and our future self and thinking about how humans have kind of core needs in the real world. You know, there are a number of different ways to explain core needs, but at a really simple level, you know, we all need to acquire, you know, items, artifacts, knowledge, skills. We need to explore, see new worlds, see what's over there, you know, climb the mountain because it's there, you know, go to new places and have new experiences. We need to play, which is we need to be entertained, and we need to connect. You know, we need to feel like we're part of something bigger and we're not isolated and lonely and on our own, but actually we have that empathy and that support from other people. And we're quite interested in what that means in the real world, but also in the digital world, and how those two worlds connect, which feeds into the second gigatrend, which is about hybrid worlds. And again, the real world and the digital world. And again, but thinking about the real and the digital together, not in isolation, but together. And how do I behave in the digital world? Is the digital world an extension of my real world, or is it a completely new space that I can be a different person, I can be a different personality? And then if I am that different personality, when I come back into the real world, does some of that digital element come back with me? I just think those things are interesting. Like, it's interesting that in Fortnite, you know, something like 9 to 10% of all people play in a different gender. Now, a lot of that is women playing as men because they don't want to be hassled. There's just that idea of like, is a digital space something new for us, or is it a reflection of the real world, or is it a completely new exploration space? And then again, what does that mean? And we're seeing lots of that in the beauty space, for example, where people are creating fantastical makeup looks that have to adhere to law of gravity and are just extraordinary in the digital space. But then they're now trying to bring those back and recreate them in actuality. There's another one around the artifacts that we will use in the digital world. And what does that mean in the real world? And the final one is, how will we control all of this? And by control, I don't mean in a kind of legal or moral sense, but I mean in a kind of just an actual management way. You know, that idea of computing used to be something that we do on laptops, but it's gravitating into our hands in terms of mobile phones, and our wrists in terms of smart watches, and into the fabric of our clothing through flexible computing and brain computing. When the power of the phone, yeah, we can wear it on our faces, but it looks fashionable. It's something that Warby Parker sells, and it doesn't look clunky, and it just folds and hides itself into the fabric of our being. How will we control it in a world where we're used to typing, clicking and dragging? And you kind of start thinking, well, more human types of interfaces are kind of where we want to be going to, you know, talk and gesture and predetermined, you know, AI and you know, emotion tracking and things around that. So again, those are also quite a lot of interesting projects that we do, where we try and think about the world without screens and the world without keyboards. That's a long, very long-winded way of saying that.
You don't define yourself, basically.
Yeah, we just basically fit ourselves into whatever shape we feel we need to be in to deliver that particular piece of work in that particular way.
And I quite like that, the fact that you don't define yourselves, because I think fashion people and fashion brands like to put other brands and other people in boxes, and the fact that you don't fit within that box is quite interesting. I always remember coming to your office over 10 years ago now, and you go back to that notion of being in, you know, the chocolate factory. For our listeners, you have to imagine going into Jonathan's office where his team are as well, and I just remember on the left hand side there was this massive Lacoste like fake shoe on the wall, and I think at the time you were looking at projection mapping, and you're like, Peter, come over here. And then you were showing me all of a sudden this Louis Vuitton table that was for Selfridges, and you were doing stuff with NFC chips and digital screens. And another side, you were showing me this very first beginnings of holograms. And everywhere I was turning in the office, there was something completely different, which I think encapsulates how you work as a, I guess, as the leader of the company and your team. But the fact that you're also looking at all of these different perspectives and seeing which one is going to work, and then how can you then make that work for the fashion brands specifically, which of course is very exciting. And in the book, you're featured in chapter 4 of Fashion Tech Applied, which is of course about marketing. And in the interview, you talked about actually the fashion show that you did for Dunhill. And the thing that really stuck out to me is the fact that you described how a spectator, a woman, was sat next to you. And because the show that your team had put on was so moving and it was so visually beautiful, that she was quietly weeping from all of these emotions that she was feeling. And going back to your earlier point, the fact that it is the consumer, it is about the viewer that comes first in any of your projects, regardless if it's tech-enabled or not, is very, very powerful. So how do you come up with such powerful concepts and to be able to draw a physical emotion from the viewer?
Yeah, that's an old project now. It must be sort of 9 or 10 years old. But the starting point was basically listing out everything that a fashion show was at that point, and then trying to do the opposite. So, you know, if you took a, I'm being very unfair to Victoria's Secrets, but just grab it, you know, that idea of light and movement and models marching down runways and a spectacle and a show, and we want to do the opposite. So the first thing that we wanted to do, and by the way, the sort of the crying was, we don't try and reduce our clients to tears. It does happen from time to time, but as a woman crying, but it was lovely. It was really nice, and it was in exactly the right kind of way. We'd triggered something within her. So the first aim was like to slow everything down. And if everything about fashion shows are about hype and movement, slow that down. The second thing that we really wanted to do was that recognition that like the runway itself means that fashion goes down, they turn, fashion comes back again, and that's it. You just don't see it. So that then led us to think, right, well, let's have the models on the stage all the time. Let's just have them there so that you can really see them. That then led to, well, if they're on the stage, what on earth are we doing? And how are we doing a show? And that then led on to the notion of holography, because we were then thinking about this notion of, we've got this classic English brand. They're in Shanghai, because China's a very big market for Dunhill. Can we have this idea of like dropping a little piece of England into the heart of Shanghai? And then we started to think about the seasons and spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And we started to think about very classic sort of English music, which was Vaughan Williams, and a really great violinist, Charlie, played this very beautiful sort of English music. But then to make it more contemporary, can we then flip it so that it feels more Chinese by the end of it? So the answer to your question is music. So we created this great show, and we created this incredible holographic display, and you would have looked at it and just gone, well, that's clever. But what we then did was, with the music, it was the music that made it moving. It was the non-tech bit that made it moving. We were also doing other night things, like some of my team were like throwing the scent of cut grass into the air and the smell of sort of wet leaves into the air and that kind of thing, just to kind of, again, get people thinking about the sort of, just to immerse you in that. But what I remember about that piece was that what triggered that emotion was the music. It wasn't the tech. And it just reinforced our view that if we're going to show tech, it needs to be ensemble with lots of other things, with stories, with place. I mean, I'll give you another example. We were doing a piece of work for that great American artist, Jenny Holzer, who's just one of our favorite superstars. And we were doing a project at Blenheim Palace. And she was talking about people who had survived Iran and Afghanistan, civilians, soldiers, very traumatic. It's very, very traumatic. And it was projected all over the outside of Blenheim. It's a piece of art. And at the dinner, a lot of people that collect art were all flown in. The kind of art world was flown in to have dinner at Blenheim and to see all the pieces. And there was exhibits everywhere, but the projections were the kind of centerpiece. And at the table that I was at, there were sort of four or five American businessmen, and I'm being a bit rude here, but they were the very worst of humanity in my experience, because they were all talking about their deals, how much money they'll make. Everything was about money. And it's like, you know, I made more money than you, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of that going on. And they kept saying to the waiter, "Waiter, we've got a flight to catch. When's the projections coming? I want to see the projections. That's why I'm here. I want to see the projections." And the waiter was saying, "It's got to be dark. It's not there yet." And but every 10 minutes, "Are they up? Are they up?" And finally, they were up. Dinner hadn't finished, but they all shot off to have a look at the projections. And they came back 20 minutes later, and they were different. They, you know, Jenny's art had changed them. They were thoughtful. They'd got it. And it's that, and what Jenny does so well, and hopefully with us too, is she had used technology not to mitigate the harshness of her communication, but to allow people to draw near and to read and to see and to understand the horrors that were projected in huge letters all over the walls of this castle. But she'd used art to allow people to get near it and to get the message without being repelled or repulsed or patronized or talked to. And I just hope that that's kind of one of the things that we do as well. And it, none of that had been, you know, they had rediscovered what it meant to be human. And if we can do a little bit of that with our work too, then I think we're getting into interesting places.
It's quite often on our podcast, because we are interviewing more of the tech-heavy companies, is that quite often we don't have the discussion about actually tech still needs to sit within the physical world, shall we say, and it's about how you use that technology to do something within the physicalities of, you know, human life. Some of the other brands that you have worked with, you talked about Dunhill there, but you've also worked with Hermes, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany, Moncler, Burberry, and the list goes on and on. You have some of the world's luxury powerhouses in your office. How do you approach like working with these? Because they're not, as you said earlier, they're not easy necessarily to work with. How do you not just combust with them being so difficult sometimes?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's a really, really good question. I mean, there are a couple of, well, first of all, they're all different. So we need to recognize that they're all different. And again, that notion of, here's my piece of tech, and I'm going to keep pushing it at you, whether you like it or not, we're the antithesis of that. So there are a couple of things. One is, rather bizarrely, I very, very rarely ever show our projects to new clients. I very, very rarely do it. And one of the reasons why I rarely do it is that I always feel it's a bit like looking at photographs of other people's children. Like, you as parents are deeply proud, but to everyone else, it's just another little kid, right? It's just another baby, and all babies look alike. And all the projects that we do, we have very, very carefully and painstakingly crafted and curated them for that particular need. And actually, you know, another client would have a completely different need and wouldn't understand any of it. So we often don't show our work, which is slightly unintuitive, but it just seems to work. And then the other thing is, all of our best projects start from conversations like we're having now, right? We just sit and we talk. And I think what happens is that brands, one, they feel that they can trust us because we understand luxury. And yeah, all of those names that you've got, we understand. I mean, I think we understand the space, maybe not perfectly, but we understand it in the way that we understand it. And it's not like we're just a tech company that's doing work with, I don't know, Lego, Marvel, whatever. You know, we really understand the importance of quality, of storytelling, of narrative. We get what these brands are trying to do, and therefore we're a safe pair of hands. But I think also that you know, a lot of the projects that we're most proud of, they didn't necessarily come with a brief, right? They just came with a desire from a brand to just explore. And when we were very lucky to do Tommy Hilfiger's fashion show at New York Fashion Week about a year and a half ago. And when I met the brand officer, it was a pitch, but it wasn't a pitch. It was a kind of a crawl with her and her team and a competitor just to see whether they liked us and whether they felt they could work with us. And one of the questions, apparently what swung it, I heard later, is I was asked, what does a good project look like? And I always feel that a good project is one where everybody learns, where we learn just as much as the brand learns. It isn't like a brand saying, here's what I want you to do, off you go and do it. Actually, these projects are a relationship. And in all good relationships, you give something and you get something back. And both parties need to do that. Both parties need to come away thinking, actually, my life has been enriched. And we definitely, from the best projects, get that. Definitely. We learn about the brand. We learn about insights into how they operate. We learn about, as long as you can try and keep that notion of new information, new insights, then I think everything works really, really well. And we're fortunate in that we're able to communicate that to brands. And I hope that they feel inspired by the way that we think. And that's what it's about. Do they think they could work with us? Will it be an interesting journey? Are we nice people? Are we efficient people? Do we challenge? Do we inspire? And if the answers to some of those questions are yes or ticks in boxes, then maybe we could do this in some way for you. And then we start with a blank sheet of paper. I mean, it's a terrible commercial, you know, way of working. You know, there's very little.
We make it work,
though. Huh? I mean, it's...
You make it work.
We will. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm feeling old. Well, maybe that's COVID. I don't know. Maybe that's the COVID.
But I think that's really important, though, because quite often I get approached by founders or startups or new business people that they come to me like, Peter, can you get me a meeting with this brand in LVMH? Peter, can you get me a meeting with this brand in Kering Group, for example? And I'm just going like, but why would they want to work with you? And they go, well, I want to sell my AR tech to them. I want to sell my digital tech to them or some sort of my new platform. I'm just like, well, just because you have the tech doesn't mean they're going to work with you. Like, there needs to be more reasons beyond the tech itself. And I think many of the fashion tech companies that I do come across, they do forget that human element. And especially when you are at the start of building your roster of clients and your portfolio, they aren't necessarily concerned by the tech that you presented to them. And you've obviously figured that out by the way you are selling to them, Jonathan. So it is working for you. And I think many of the founders, I'm told to forget about that.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned I was in New York and I was at the NRF show just walking around. And I'd never done the NRF show because, yeah, as we've talked about over the last few minutes, everything that we do is completely different. I don't have a thing, a widget to sell. We have ideas. But as I walked around NRF and I saw vendor after vendor that were selling really important, powerful tech, I very quickly looked around and thought, I don't belong here. You know, I just don't understand any of this. I would stop at a vendor and ask what they do. And they were absolutely specializing in data that comes out of customers that have gone into the basket, but then fallen out. And why have they fallen out? And it's just that little tiny little bit. And I didn't understand it. I mean, I understood what they were trying to do, but it very quickly got into a very deep tech conversation that, by the way, is critical to a brand. No doubt about it. I'm not denigrating it. I think it was incredible, but it's just not us. And none of the things that I saw there were kind of us. I felt very alien there. What I want to do is get on that sofa and have a chat to people about insights and about things that make the hair on the back of the neck stand up, because wow, I yeah, we've kind of created an emotional connection. It's that poor girl crying at the Dunhill. You know, that's what we want. Yeah, but actually, that's what fashion does, right? So, you know, why do we wear fashion? We do it for a number of reasons, but to trigger a response or to fit in, or, you know, and I mean, I love that kind of quote. I guess, I mean, I come from De Beers, right? And De Beers were very clever at creating emotions around products. And, you know, there's that great quote, which is not from De Beers, but it's very, in a very similar, like very similar place from Charles Revlon in the 1920s. Like, I don't sell the cream that comes out of the tube. I sell the feeling that the woman has walking down Fifth Avenue, feeling $1 million. I think about that a lot. And again, at De Beers, I think about a sparkly stone, sparkle equals love. The more sparkle, the more love. What is more important in this world than love? If you can link diamonds to love, that's incredible. And that's what I did for 20 years while I worked for De Beers. But it's marketing, right? It's a piece of marketing strategy, diamonds and love. But when I got married and I gave my wife an engagement ring, I knew it was a conceit. And I'm quite a cynical person. And I loved every minute of it, you know? So yeah. Yeah, and it's one of the most important moments of my life. And I knew that it wasn't real, that it was a marketing play. But it was so strong and so powerful that I was absolutely, completely all over it. So, yeah, again, a lot of technology is rational.
So not even you could get over the sparkles.
No.
Jonathan, no. You still went for the sparkles.
We're talking to a luxury car manufacturer at the moment. And, you know, they're all about speed and acceleration and performance and the quality of the stitches. You know, that's the things that turn them on. And by the way, they do very well with that kind of message. But we were having other types of conversations. You know, the car is a physical object, right? But a car can take you to meet friends. A car, you know, I'm going to get in the car later today and take my family up to see their grandmother, you know, and we'll get out of the car and there'll be hugs and my mum will be just so happy to see the kids. And, you know, there was a story that I was watching. My son, when he was a teenager, was quite into kind of Top Gear and those car guys. And yeah, they're all kids really, aren't they, those guys? Jeremy Clarkson was quite clever because he plays the buffoon, but then he was driving this Porsche and suddenly he talked about this story where actually he was in his 20s and he had one of those cars. And he had a phone call from his mother who said his father had a stroke and wasn't projected to live the night. And he got in that car and that car was fast enough to get him so that he could actually say goodbye to his father. And I don't know. I think there's something interesting. We were doing a work for airports at Christmas and you know, we were thinking about airports are awful places in many ways, but come Christmas or Thanksgiving, they're places where they're like gateways where people come for emotional journeys. You know, you travel home for Christmas. You travel to meet loved ones. You go through that airport to be with your family and to have that fantastic feeling of being togetherness. During the year, we all spread out, but we come together. No matter where we are in the world, we come together. There's a sort of an emotional connection and a warmth. And actually, if we can link that notion of an airport rather than just as a kind of a hub, but as a gateway to warmth and love, then we can start to get into interesting places. So I guess that's just the way that we kind of think. How do we drill anything back to that notion of being human? And again, one of the things I think is really, when you think about the really powerful technologies, like the really powerful ones, they're not visible, right? They're invisible. They sort of fold themselves into the way that we kind of live. And, you know, these mobile phones are a really good case in point, right? We don't think about them. And it's how we find out about the world, and it's how we find out about our friends and whether they're happy or sad. And yes, echo chambers and algorithms and all of that. But like, I don't think about this. It's just it's like a hand, right? It's like a part of my body. And I think most tech that I see in the fashion world, and the most of them in that world, I notice it. And I think, and headsets are a good example. If I notice it, then it's not intuitive yet. It will get there. It will get there. But right here, right now, today, actually, the more of a barrier between us, separating us from brands, rather than, you know, something that's more seamless and kind of hides that kind of no man's land between us and the brand. We need ways of drawing us in. And again, I think a lot of technology does the opposite of what it's trying to do.
I think our listeners, just by listening to you talk, Jonathan, you have a lot of stories that you could tell. I'm pretty sure that you and I could just talk all day, to be honest. But I want to finish the episode off with a quick fire round of questions. So the first question, first answer that comes to your head, are you ready?
Go for it.
Have you read Fashion Tech Applied yet?
Not yet. I'm looking forward to doing so, though. In the very near future.
The copy's coming your way.
In the very near future, Lisa.
Your favorite client project that you've worked on?
It's going to have to be one of the art projects, either the work we do with Jenny Holzer, but probably also Dream Machine, which is part of the Unbox Festival. Look it up on our site. It was a journey into the very depths of your mind, a journey of neuroscience, and I loved it.
Digital or physical marketing?
Yeah, so neither. We're trying to explore that space where the two merge. We don't use the word digital because it's banned from our agency. I don't like it. But each of those has got interesting opportunities, and it's trying to merge those opportunities into a third way.
I completely agree with the word digital. It's overused corporate buzzword, but that's a conversation
that's
another
conversation
day.
Yeah.
One digital design tool that you can't live without?
My team. I know that sounds crass and trite, but I mean, my team are the makers. Like I say, I think if I have a value to Helition, it's as a very light hand on the tiller, gently sort of keeping the nose of the boat in the right direction. But the power, it all comes from the team. I couldn't do without them.
Best piece of advice for creators wanting to join or build their own creative studio?
So a couple of things. First of all, embrace chaos. Recognize that it's very difficult to plan for anything. And actually life as a startup is tumbling down a hill, but you will get to the bottom. I think also don't worry about decisions that you haven't made. Like if you get to a crossroads and you can go left or right, don't worry. Don't go down the right one and think I should have gone down the left one. Once you've started on something, keep pushing, keep going, and never, ever, ever be afraid to change or pivot. Just my life since starting Helition itself, all the variety of work that we've been talking about, it's as a result of pivots. Just see where the value is and go for it. And don't, the kind of tree that bends with the wind survives. Don't be afraid to check different routes, different ideas.
I love that. On that note, everyone embrace chaos. I think that's going to be my mantra. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Jonathan.
A real pleasure. And good luck with the book. And I will be reading it as soon as I can get my hands on a copy.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to click follow to keep up to date with the latest episodes. And if you like this episode, please give us a review. If you want us to feature a specific theme or guest, please give us a message at beyondform.io. I will see you very soon.